welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. There is a lot of excitement around the potential for psychedelics to treat a host of psychiatric problems. Drugs like ketamine, MDMA, often known as Molly or ecstasy, and psilocybin, the hallucinogenic substance in magic mushrooms, are being studied to treat depression, anxiety, substance use disorders, and PTSD. An increasing body of research shows these plant-based compounds have real promise. But of course, there is also a lot of hype surrounding these compounds, and there are businesses that are trying to cash in on the psychedelic boom by offering therapy, products, retreats, and more. So this hour, a conversation about psychedelics in mental health treatment, their potential, and their risks. We'll talk about how these drugs affect the brain, altered states of consciousness, and the stigma still associated with them. Our first guest this hour is David Yaden. He is assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and he's working in the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. His research is focused on the therapeutic potential of psychedelic substances for mood and substance use disorders, and he is the co-author with Andrew Newberg of the new book, The Varieties of Spiritual Experience, 21st Century Research and Perspectives. David Yaden, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
And let me just take a moment to invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can call us at 888-477-9499. That said, David Yaden, let's begin at the beginning. What exactly do we mean when we use the term psychedelics? We listed a couple of examples there, but what exactly are psychedelics?
Yeah, so psychedelics are a diverse group of psychoactive compounds. They dramatically alter one's state of consciousness, and that usually occurs anywhere from half an hour to several hours. But otherwise, this group is fairly diverse. So you mentioned psilocybin, MDMA, and ketamine. Each of these are distinct from one another. And increasingly, when people are saying the word psychedelic, they're really referring to what we call the classic psychedelics, such as psilocybin or magic mushrooms and LSD.
And what about ketamine? What exactly is that? Is that in a somewhat different category from some of the others?
Yes, I would put it in a slightly different category. It's a dissociative anesthetic, and so it has a different mechanism of action in the brain, and people report feeling differently when they take it from how they feel under psilocybin. That is FDA approved for depression, but the effects are rather short-lived, and so there's some excitement around psilocybin because it appears that the beneficial effects, the antidepressant effects, might be longer lasting.
David, there has been, as you well know, so much stigma around psychedelics going back decades when they were like public enemy number one in the war on drugs. Many
yes.
of them were criminalized. Why are psychedelics having a moment now?
Yeah, it's such an important point. We've received decades of misinformation, fear-mongering, alarmism around these substances. So it's no surprise that they would be stigmatized and felt to be somewhat taboo. But back in the 50s and the early 60s, there was some good research about the anti-addictive qualities of psilocybin, the use for alcoholism, for example, as well as depression. And that research was just sort of buried for a number of decades. And it's really only in the past 10 to 15 years or so that research out of Johns Hopkins, led by Roland Griffiths and others, has brought these substances back into public consciousness and shown that they're relatively safe in clinical settings, although there are risks. And there can be substantial benefits to well-being. So I think that's what sparked the interest in using these substances for therapeutic applications. And we've seen a few clinical trials in both mood and substance use disorders at this point, More research needs to be done, but at this point, the data is very promising.
And David, we mentioned a couple of the disorders that these psychedelics can help to treat. You've mentioned depression and anxiety. We've talked about PTSD. Apparently, there are other issues, too. There are other disorders that can be effectively treated, at least as far as the research is telling us now, by psychedelic therapy.
That's right. Yeah, MDMA, as you mentioned, commonly called Molly or ecstasy, is currently in phase 3 trials for PTSD. And then psilocybin, which is, again, magic mushrooms, a different substance. Both are sometimes referred to under the umbrella term psychedelics. That's being explored more so for treatment-resistant depression. So right now, treatment-resistant depression and PTSD are the major diagnoses that are being targeted, but there is some signal that psilocybin in particular might be useful for those with alcohol use disorder or even tobacco use disorder.
David, can you talk about the importance of this moment? I mean, we just talked about why psychedelics are having a moment, but in the larger context of the mental health crises that we are seeing around the country, you know, especially over the last few years, when you think about COVID and everything that that has caused in terms of mental health crises, can you just talk about the larger mental health context that we're in right now?
Yeah, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we're in a mental health pandemic of a kind. 1 in 5 Americans will experience a mental illness in a given year. And by some estimates, about 50% of Americans will be diagnosed with a mental illness at some point in their lifetime. So everyone knows someone who is impacted by mental illness and often suffering dramatically. And there's a real urgent need to develop new understandings and new tools to help us address this very, very widespread mental illness. And so we think that psychedelics could be a part of that solution. Not the whole thing, but they do seem to help us understand how the mind works in some ways, how altered states of consciousness can be beneficial in certain contexts, and may provide clinicians with a new tool in their toolbox to help address those suffering from mental illness alongside other evidence-based tools.
And I want to mention that in just a few minutes, we will be hearing from an Air Force combat veteran who is also the founder and president of Balanced Veterans Network, who has experienced some of this psychedelic-assisted therapy and to great success. And we'll be hearing from him shortly. But David, until then, why do these kinds of psychedelics work where other methodologies have, I won't say failed, but maybe come up short or shown some limitations? What is it about them that treats otherwise treatment-resistant conditions?
Well, that's the big question, this issue of mechanism. And to take a step back, in terms of efficacy, we still do need to do bigger, better studies to establish that. And as we said, there's been decades of negativity, alarmism, fear-mongering. In the past few years, we've seen a lot of positive hype going well beyond the evidence. And so we have to be careful about the way that we talk about the potential for psychedelics in a way that respects the current state of the evidence. And I think what the current state of the evidence is that there's real potential here. There are risks, and these are not cure-alls, but there does seem to be real potential for psychedelics to become a new effective treatment for several major mental disorders. Now, the question about how they work or why they work is something that myself and a number of my colleagues across various different disciplines, from pharmacology to animal researchers to neuroscientists, psychologists, clinicians. Many people are working together to try to understand why is it that psychedelics work. There's a number of possibilities at different what we call levels of analysis. So if we zoom in all the way to the neuron level, there's some evidence that psychedelics increase neurogenesis or neuron growth, so the cells in the brain actually branching out more, and neuroplasticity, so allowing for changes to occur in the brain. If we look up a little bit to more about brain function, evidence from neuroimaging, for example, we see a number of different theories that look at, for example, a kind of sensory overload, a kind of subregions of the brain being connected to one another at greater rates, and a temporary kind of lessening of certain forms of cognitive control. All of these things potentially allowing people to break out of rigid thought and behavior patterns in some way. But the mechanism is not known exactly on the brain level. On the psychological level, people feel increased positive emotions after their experience, deeper feelings of connection to other people, loved ones, even existence as a whole. And there are reports of shifts in healthy behavior patterns. And so that's a lot. Those are a lot of different levels of analysis, all the way from the neuron to how the brain is working as a whole, to thoughts and feelings. And all of these things seem to be happening at the same time. So there's this question of whether we can have an integrated view and understanding of why all of these things are happening at once. That's what we're driving for. Yeah. Though some people think that each of these levels of analysis need to be looked at on their own in this sort of separate way. And so we'll always have to look separately at what the brain is doing, what neurons are doing, all the way up to function as a whole, as well as psychologically. Yeah. So that's a long way of saying we don't know exactly how psychedelics are producing these beneficial effects, but many people are working on it, and there are a number of theories as of now.
We have so much to talk about on this topic. When we come back, we will be hearing from an Air Force combat veteran who has struggled with PTSD, who has tried these therapies with success. We'll talk about what a therapeutic session is like, what are the risks, what is the future of psychedelic-assisted therapy, that and much more when Radio Times comes right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. This hour, we're talking about the potential of psychedelic drugs to treat a host of mental health issues. We've been talking with David Yaden, a researcher who studies psychedelics and altered states of consciousness at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us now is Ron Millward, an Air Force combat veteran and the founder and president of the Balanced Veterans Network, which introduces veterans and their families to alternative therapies. He served for 7 years across the Middle East and in South Korea and has struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder in the aftermath. Ron has participated in psychedelic-assisted therapy, and for him, it has been a game changer. Ron, welcome to Radio Times, and thank you for your service.
Thank you so incredibly much. It is such an honor to be here and to be talking about this in today's society. I'm incredibly grateful and blessed to have this opportunity.
Well, I imagine our listeners will have questions for you and for David Yaden, so let me give that information again. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, or give us a call at 888-477-9499. Ron, I'll begin with you, and I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your experience with PTSD when you first came home and what your life was like at that point.
Yeah, and it's really challenging to look back on and to revisit at times, but I joined the military at 17, and so from my time at 17 to 24 was really a complete whirlwind. I had moved around 30 times, I had deployed multiple times, I unfortunately lost a few friends to suicide while in the military, and really didn't have a chance to process it. It all hits so fast. You're moving, you're on to the next mission, you're doing your job, and really it's sort of what you signed up for and didn't realize it. And so when I finally did slow down and tried to land, my life was a whirlwind. I ended up drinking alcohol a lot. I was married and went through a divorce at the time. I was truly not myself and unfortunately fell victim to polypharmacy, which is very common for veterans. I was prescribed multiple pharmaceuticals. At one point, I was on 9 different pharmaceuticals and completely lost touch of who I was as a person and really could not feel my emotions and was not able to really process what was happening and ultimately led to me trying to commit suicide. I just could not ground. I could not see purpose and direction moving forward and felt like that was the way to go. I had experienced that so many times from other people taking their lives and felt like that may be an option, and it's not.
Yeah. And thankfully, you did not take that step. What was it that got you to consider psychedelic assisted therapy?
Well, believe it or not, it actually started with cannabis. I had a friend introduce me to cannabis, and that had slowly started my distance from pharmaceuticals to be able to sort of look at some different alternative options outside of what I'd been trying. I'd been very involved in talk therapy. I had, again, been trying the pharmaceuticals that were prescribed for me and still really struggling with suicidal ideations and flashbacks and re-experiencing some of the times that I was in the military. And, so the cannabis was that first sort of introduction. Some folks do believe that cannabis is a psychedelic compound. And so on the lighter spectrum of that, it started to create some space for me to start to make some healthier choices. Within that, I was still not wholly there. You know, I was still having some of those challenges. And I fortunately had a friend reach out to me and told me about psilocybin mushrooms. And there was a decriminalized area in California where I was able to experience a retreat and for the first time, psilocybin.
Tell us about that experience. What was that like?
Yeah, it was extremely powerful, and sometimes I have a difficult time putting it into words, but I was very scared. I grew up conservative, Christian. This was like the furthest thing from really anything I thought I would ever try, and to be honest with you, I can't believe I'm sitting here talking about this right now, but it's a beautiful thing. I very ceremonious. We did some meditation, which was something that was new for me, so learning how to just be a little bit more mindful and get in touch with your inner self, your voice, your breath, and so learning some of those skills, but then introducing the compound, wow, it was quite the experience. And thank you, Professor David, for being here and explaining what you had explained earlier, but I'd felt like all at once, all of those things, the bliss, the joy, the love, the comfort, you sort of experience those all at one time, and it can be a little bit overwhelming, and luckily, I was there with some folks, and I believe the most important part of this is the set and setting and having folks there to guide you and to be able to have conversations with throughout and be there to safely facilitate that. And so as I started to experience some of those emotions, I felt something that I hadn't felt really in a long time. I don't want to get emotional, but it's challenging not to. I felt this deep love for myself, and You know, I think when we get so detached from ourselves when we're on pharmaceuticals, experience a lot of trauma, you lose that sense. You lose yourself. And when I was able to find that love for myself, again, it was sort of like a renewed purpose, a renewed vision. And I knew that I needed to do something. And so these compounds, they're not the magic cure. I know they call them magic mushrooms, but you know, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort to really integrate the things that happen during those sessions. And so your mind is expanded there for a short period of time. I was able to think a little bit differently. I was able to revisit some of my traumas. And instead of being scared or struggling with that, I had compassion. I had a love for myself and an understanding that was a little bit different. And so leaving that, I was able to then just sort of approach life differently. I started to make healthier choices. I started to just incorporate different practices of mindfulness and continuing to try to go back to that sort of state of understanding and finding myself.
Yeah. And David Yaden, I'm coming to you in just a moment, but one other question for you, Ron, and that is, did you see then a lessening of your PTSD symptoms as well?
It was tough to tell right away. But slowly I started to realize I was, and this is the thing, and I want to make sure folks know this, I am not cured by any means. This takes a lot of effort. And, you know, I think a lot of veterans are afraid of, again, whether that's, you know, your disability or whatever you're rated for at the VA to share that something is maybe helping you. But it did. It allowed me to, again, think differently about some of those traumas. I was not so reactive to some of my emotions. I was just able to just see them, feel them, and experience them without actually reacting. And that, I think, has been the most, the biggest relief for me.
Yeah. David Yaden, I'd love for you to comment on this. Does what Ron is describing sound consistent with what your research is telling you?
Well, yeah, I just want to thank Ron for sharing that story. Incredibly interesting, but also brave to describe that, and in such a measured way. Ron's story, I think, is a success story. And we do have those, and we do see that in the data. Some people report positively transformative experiences. Some people are helped a little bit, some people not at all, and some people report adverse events. A fairly small percentage. So psychedelics are not for everyone. And then pharmaceuticals can also be beneficial for some people. So, you know, we're not trying to replace anything. The idea is to add another therapeutic tool. But when you hear Ron talk about those deep feelings of love for himself that he experienced, I mean, wow, that's it's moving to hear that. And I think it's extraordinary when you do hear an experience like that, that is so profound and positive and meaningful. And so I think it's a wonderful story, and it does demonstrate the reality of what can happen from these treatments in some cases.
And David, that description, the self-love that Ron experienced, and the idea of creating space in your mind to think differently and to make different decisions. Is that really where the power lies with psychedelics, to kind of create space to maybe make a kind of pivot that you might not be able to make with other therapies?
I think it's quite possible. You know, there's a lot of debate about the mechanisms, like we talked about earlier. But to me, it seems like these deep feelings of love for other people and even for oneself are an important part of this. And then, yeah, the space that you mention where insights can occur that aren't just intellectual insights, but really deeply felt. You know, sometimes people call these the Hallmark card insights, you know, where when you say them, they sound a little trite, like, you know, I love my family and friends. I need to take care of myself. You know, these kinds of statements where you might think, oh, well, that's obvious. But during these experiences, these insights are felt on a very profound level, and they seem to have more ability to create real behavior change, and sometimes change beliefs about oneself, one's future, the world as a whole, and change behavior in a lasting way. And so I think that's what's so interesting about these potential treatments.
Yeah, someone said that words just don't adequately communicate sometimes what that experience can be like. Let me read a couple of comments from our listeners. Joe says, I used psychedelic compounds to treat my opioid addiction and am now 2 years clean.
Yes.
And credit them with saving my life. Mm. Joe, congratulations. That is wonderful news. Jake says, I was twice treated with ketamine at a clinic and really didn't get anything out of it other than feeling high. But also, he says, all the therapy was out of pocket, and that makes me wonder who will be able to afford these therapies. And there could be a lot of people who don't get access to them. Ron, your work is all about access, particularly for veterans. Talk about that question of access.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. And, you know, I think that is, as this expands and as we talk about, you know, some of the legalization side of this and the medicalization of some of these, you know, they talk about the potential of MDMA and psilocybin being a prescribed medicine in the future. There is going to be some of that, the access issue. And I think that that has always been the case. But there are some amazing organizations that are helping sort of circumvent the costs of that here in the early stages. And I'm grateful again for Professor David to say that psychedelics are not for everyone, and pharmaceuticals, I believe, are not for everyone, but finding something that may work, you know, that is a really powerful thing. As far as the access, I think that's what's exciting about the potential of some of these pilot programs and being able to, you know, right now it's very strict criteria talking about severe, you know, sort of cancer patients, end-of-life care, severe mental health disorders, being able to have access to that. But there are folks that maybe didn't even experience any combat trauma, or, you know, maybe struggling with opioid addictions and or military sexual trauma, sexual assault, things like that, that I believe that these could also be helpful in just thinking differently about those situations. So access is major, and something that, you know, I really hope that people do consider. The majority of veterans are living on fixed incomes and could not afford these treatments. Even right now, as ketamine is really booming in Philadelphia, there are quite a few clinics and folks educating on that. It's extremely expensive. Yeah. And not affordable for folks.
When you say it's extremely expensive, ballpark, what does it cost to engage in that sort of therapy?
I believe that somebody told me that the recommended is around 6 to 8 sessions of this, and they can be anywhere from $8 to $1,200 plus. Plus a session. And so it can get really expensive really quick. But yeah. I'm not, you know, please don't quote me on that.
Yeah. Here's an email from Kelly who says, I've suffered with episodic anxiety as a result of multiple childhood traumas. Therapy has only helped moderately. I would like to try this new modality, but one of my older siblings suffered a single psychotic episode decades ago. Mm. Would that exclude me from the psychedelic treatment? David Yaden, I'll direct that to you because it goes to the risks that may be involved, and we haven't talked a lot about that.
Yes, well, I'm so glad you've included positive experiences, even profoundly positive experiences, neutral experiences, and then here maybe an adverse event, a risk. So currently at Johns Hopkins, we do exclude those who have a personal or family history of psychotic disorder. And so that would exclude the caller from our studies, at least. This is something that will likely change, you know, as these samples get larger and more diverse. Will include more and more individuals. And so we'll be able to look at, you know, who really shouldn't probably have a psychedelic experience and what kind of person might be more likely to benefit.
And David, give us...
So this really gets to this issue of... Oh, well, I was just going to say briefly, this gets to this issue of safety versus access and these two values that are both really important but sometimes come into tension. And so the more safety procedures that we put into place, a lot of times that drives the cost up, which makes these treatments less accessible. So safety and access is a real tension in the field that researchers are talking about, but also policymakers and activists and others.
And David, what about just the practical risks? Because obviously having a psychotic episode could happen, a bad trip, as they call it. Is there risk of addiction? Are there physical side effects that could take place? I mean, what are the potential risks here?
So there are definitely risks, but overdose and addiction are actually not much of risks with psychedelics, or they're much less than other recreational substances. The risks are more so being in a vulnerable state, sometimes confused and maybe suggestible or influenced by other people. And so these risks are really magnified in recreational settings, like a concert, for example, where you may not have someone really looking after you and guiding you and making sure you're in a safe setting, like the ceremony that Ron described and like in our clinical trials. So there are real risks. They are definitely magnified in recreational settings. There's a number of things we try to do in the clinical trial setting. So we do screen individuals who might have a risk factor. We prepare people for their experience. We educate them about what to expect and just build a connection between the therapist and the participant. And then during the session itself, you know, there's medical staff on hand. It's a comfortable living room like setting. There are therapists on hand, and after the experience, someone who's a loved one, a trusted person, will drive the individual back to their home. And then afterwards, there are integration sessions as well, so you can talk about your experience with someone that you trust. So all of these things that we do in a clinical trial setting really increase safety, and you don't have really any of those things in a lot of recreational settings.
Yeah. Well,
so those risks do increase.
And I'm glad that you mentioned recreational use, because, of course, that is a big concern as, you know, we begin to talk about this more and more studies are done. So we want to talk about that when we come back from the break, as well as sort of the business side of this. There are lots of companies that are popping up that are publicly traded that are getting involved in all of this. So we want to talk about that as well. And that issue of trust that you just brought up, very important to talk about, too. So much more on psychedelic-assisted therapy when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about psychedelic drugs. They are having a moment and are really the subject of a number of studies. They are showing promise in treating a host of psychiatric disorders, anxiety, depression, PTSD, potentially migraines, alcoholism. There are all kinds of disorders that psychedelic drugs may, in fact, be effective in treating. And so that's what we have been talking about. Our guests are David Yaden, who is assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He works in the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. Also with us is Ron Millward, who is an Air Force combat veteran. He's the founder and president of Balanced Veterans Network, which provides education and advocacy of alternative therapies for veterans and their families. We invite you to add your voice to our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or call us at 888-477-9499. David Yaden, when we left off, you were talking about, you mentioned recreational use, and of course that's got to be a big concern as we're sort of working on the medical side and the safety side of all of this, that there has been a push in some quarters for recreational use. Talk about that and sort of where we are and the concerns around recreational use of these substances.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, risks do go up substantially in recreational settings, less controlled environments, less supportive individuals around who have expertise psychologically and medically. So there are real risks to recreational use. But psychedelics ask us to do something that our society isn't particularly good at, which is to think in a nuanced way about a topic and not shift into black or white thinking. And so you can acknowledge that psychedelics do have real risks without going into full-on fear-mongering and alarmism. And I think that that's a really important kind of tension to hold in this topic. And so, you know, I have real worries about recreational use, but you also need to contextualize the risks of psychedelics compared to other common recreational substances. And when you compare, when you make that comparison, psychedelics are in some ways safer than many commonly used mm-hmm. recreational substances.
The other point that I wanted to touch on quickly was the point that David mentioned, Ron, about trust and the importance of trust in relationships like this when you are working with someone in a setting where you're doing psychedelic-assisted therapy. Trust is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that it takes time to establish trust, but there are many people, I'd like to mention Sound Mind Institute here in Philadelphia, where they are training facilitators for folks to be able to have the education and knowledge around supporting and being able to be helpful through those experiences. One thing, I know that we're going to get into the business side and the medicalization side and all of that, but I do want to make sure we mention that these compounds are in nature. They grow naturally. And, you know, from indigenous cultures, they've been using these for the longest time. And so I think that as we start to have more education and parameters around the research and the studies that come out and all of the very important people, which I'm incredibly grateful for, that are researching and understanding this. For me personally, coming from the veteran community, there was an article released that some of the suicide statistics that were mentioned in the veteran community were actually lower than the actual suicides. And so our community is experiencing an epidemic, and I know everyone is experiencing mental health, but being able to have another option, another tool to be able to try to use, I think if somebody's at the end of their rope, being able to potentially experience something like this, regardless of understanding there may be side effects, I think that having the option should definitely be available for folks, but again, not for everyone.
Yeah. There are so many other things that we want to make sure that we touch on. And one, Ron, is legislation. There's legislation pending here in Pennsylvania. A number of states are looking at this because the question is, wait a minute, so many of these substances are illegal. How are people getting access to them for these therapies? What are states doing? How are people thinking about this legislatively? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it seems like there's sort of two tracks right now. There are many states that have already decriminalized these compounds for religious use and for folks to be able to use that in sort of a healing way. And I know we had sat down with city council and talked about that here in Philadelphia. And so grateful for the folks that are open to being educated and understanding how these can help. But then there is that legalization side, where I believe the research is very important. And I want to shout out Representative Tracy Pennycook and Representative Greg Rothman for all of the work and support that they've done to just introduce the idea. We had a press conference in Harrisburg a few months ago, and we're able to have so many people from Pennsylvania share their stories around how these had helped. And so introducing research, I believe that's the first step for folks to understand what this is actually doing, how this is helping, to then create the legislation that allows the access. And but again, hopefully with some of the potential right to try amendments, there will be funding to help some veterans or lower income to be able to access these and have the opportunity to try.
Speaking of shout outs, I have an email here from Emily who says, in January 2017, I took MDMA and psilocybin. I took it with intention after doing my own research after a lot of childhood trauma. I spent 6 hours with my inner child and worked through things that were still holding us back. She says, I met Ron at the National Cannabis Festival in D.C., and between my own experiences and seeing him, I have to believe that this is the answer for our trauma epidemic. So wow. Shout out there from Emily.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Samantha says on Facebook, I started microdosing magic mushrooms as treatment for ADHD, PTSD, and anxiety, and the amount of healing I'm experiencing is mind-blowing. So Samantha, thank you for that, and Emily for your email as well. David, want to talk about the business side of this, because you have expressed concerns about the hype around this, that, you know, there are companies popping up all over the place. Some are publicly traded. There can be efforts to cash in on this and perhaps even re-stigmatize some of these substances. What are your concerns, and how do you see sort of the business side of this developing?
Yeah, it's an important issue. So we had these decades of just complete alarmism and over-the-top fear-mongering that was totally divorced from the evidence. Now, in the past few years, in part because of these business developments, there's a lot of people who are motivated to go the other way and to say over-the-top claims in the positive direction. You know, that these substances can cure mental illness, they can solve all these massive social problems. And I think there's real harm in making those kinds of over-the-top positive statements. I've really appreciated Ron's measured approach and talking about his experience and psychedelics in general. And I think that's the kind of approach that we need. It needs to be a little complicated. We need to give qualifications, and we can be optimistic, but we should be cautiously optimistic and really fund more research so that we can understand the risks and the benefits as well as potential mechanisms of why psychedelics result in many of these beneficial effects. So the money flowing in to this area is helpful in some ways because it could increase access. And I think that's an important point to make. And yet we need to be careful that we don't fall into over-the-top positive statements either.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that. I have such a deep reverence and really a healthy fear for these compounds, and I think that everybody should. I believe that, you know, these have the potential to help change, but I want to make sure we mention that you are the medicine. You know, these compounds may introduce you to a new way of thinking, but it's on you to take those steps to make the changes in your life. I mean, the integration, the aftercare is the most crucial part to all of this. And so while these compounds, you know, some folks, and it's so beautiful to hear some of these stories, and thank you all for sharing. You know, there is healing that's happening, but remember that's through you making changes in your life. It's not necessarily these compounds doing that.
Yeah, important point. David, Samantha mentioned in her Facebook post about microdosing, which leads me to a question about the mommy microdosing movement, say that four times fast, that there's a growing number of moms, and this was reported on NPR recently, who are now microdosing mushrooms to cope with the stress of raising young children. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I'm not really sure what to make of that. That's the first I'm hearing of that particular group. The evidence for microdosing, I have to say, is much more mixed. In trials that are really well blinded so that people don't know whether they're actually receiving psilocybin or placebo, it looks like there's little to maybe no effect. And so we need to do more research and bigger studies on microdosing. But there doesn't seem to be this strong signal for effectiveness like we're seeing in the larger doses. And in fact, we call those larger doses either macrodoses or heroic doses. And so these very high doses of psilocybin appear to be more therapeutically effective. And so we're still keeping our eye on the microdosing literature in these studies, but it's not quite as promising, I would say.
Hmm. Question from Susan, who says, is there any evidence that psilocybin can affect pathways in the brain that could treat movement disorders? David, what does the research say about that, if anything, at this point?
I think the research is pretty silent on that question. But we are in this exploratory phase, I think, where we're looking across indications and seeing where and what disorders psilocybin might be effective. And so I think we're still in that exploratory phase, going around the space of potential disorders and looking at boundary conditions. So I'm not sure that we have good data to speak to that quite yet.
There is also a question from, or actually an email from Jennifer, who mentions that LSD-assisted therapy decades ago inspired a type of music therapy called guided imagery and meditation, when a music therapist guides a client through specially crafted classical music programs designed to bring the client to a relaxed and altered state. The music therapist assists in processing the experience, the images and the emotions that are brought forth by the music program. So it sounds, Ron, like a similar, obviously without the psychedelics, but using music in a similar way.
Yeah, there. I mean, outside of the psychedelics, there are many different modalities and therapies that can be super helpful. I had the opportunity to sit underneath this light that actually stimulates your pineal gland and has a very similar effect that releases natural DMT in your body, and you can sort of have that experience.
Yeah. And what is DMT?
Professor David would love for the actual technical term there, but DMT is a naturally occurring compound that happens inside of our brain, and you know, it's released in many different ways. But I believe that, again, with music and therapy and understanding the brain waves, and there are even like vibrational pads, there are so many different therapies that are being explored outside of psychedelics. And so using those in conjunction with psychedelics can be helpful for some folks, I believe. But, Yeah. You know, again, it's different for everybody.
And Ron, how important do you think talk therapy is in conjunction maybe with psychedelic-assisted therapy?
Absolutely vital. Our brains can go really deep, and I believe having somebody to be able to have some of those conversations with, ask questions, break down some of the things you may be thinking and feeling, and sort of ground, it's incredibly valuable and helpful. And outside of the talk therapy, having a healthy community of other folks that have maybe experienced this, that you can again ask questions, or if you're struggling a little bit, be able to relate with somebody.
Yeah, so it's not an either or, it's a both and.
It's a both
right?
and, yes.
Yeah. David Yaden, in our last few minutes here, I'd like you to talk about where you see all of this going. I mean, we've talked about legislation, we've talked about studies, we've talked about the business angle and maybe some of the concerns around the hype around all of this. But what is your best hope for where you see all of this ending up in the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
Wow, that's a great question. I would say, first of all, we are in a mental health crisis. And so we do have evidence-based treatments already available. And so I would say, I would invite people to avail themselves of the current evidence-based treatments that are available. And don't wait for psychedelics. And so I think we need a kind of complementary way of thinking about psychedelics. I think they could be an effective tool in the toolbox of physicians and clinicians, but I don't think that they're going to replace all of the evidence-based treatments that we have already. So that said, My greatest hope would be that we understand why psychedelics work so well for some people and why they don't seem to work for others. So really drilling down into understanding the mechanisms of psychedelics, I think, is what is most exciting to me. And I think that could create some very effective treatments in the future.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for all of the work that you are doing in this regard. We have been talking about psychedelic-assisted therapy and how psychedelics are having a moment. Our guests have been David Yaden from Johns Hopkins University, where he researches psychedelics, and also Air Force combat veteran Ron Millward, who has used psychedelic-assisted therapy, and he's the founder and president of Balanced Veterans Network. Thanks to you both for being on Radio Times. Our producers are Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer today was Al Banks, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY.